Welcome to Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. Today, I am chatting with Dr. Lee Hadlington about online safety and security. Lee is a senior lecturer in cyber psychology and co-course leader for the MSc in cyber psychology at Nottingham Trent University. Welcome, Lee. I'm so delighted to have you on board.
Thank you, Caroline. Happy to be here.
Lee, before we get chatting about the work you do and your research, can you tell me a little bit more about who you are, what you do, and what the pivot point was that sent you down the road of cyber psychology?
Yeah, I can do that. So as you introduced me, I am Dr. Lee Hadlington. I am a cyber psychologist at Nottingham Trent University. I have co-course leadership for our wonderful MSc in cyber psychology at Nottingham Trent. And I also teach some parts on the undergraduate course where we have an optional module on cyber psychology. What do I do? Sometimes I have to think about that myself on a daily basis. So my research interests cover, I will say very broadly, risk online. So anything from cyber security, cyber resilience, susceptibility to cyber crime. Big chunk of our work is human factors in cybersecurity. So looking at how we can apply the human factors paradigm to understanding why people have issues with their behavior when it comes to cybersecurity, but also helping organizations understand how they can better sort of harness individuals in terms of cybersecurity behavior and cybersecurity awareness. My pivot point for setting me down the road on the path in cyber psychology is actually an interesting one, because I actually just stumbled into it. And I literally did stumble into it because I remember I was having, I was at De Montfort University, and I just walked into a room where I probably shouldn't have been. And one of my colleagues was having a meeting with a group from the DSTL, Defence Science Technology Laboratories. And they were talking about cognitive processes online and how we process information online. And my colleague sort of introduced me because I'd walked into the room and by area. And they said, oh, you know, what could you contribute? And it was like, I said, oh, actually, this is quite interesting. And that led to me being involved on a project with DSTL, which then led me to publishing my first paper on smart mobile phone addiction and cognitive failures, which, you know, was obviously really well received. And I started to think, well, actually, my background's in cognition and cognitive psychology. There's quite a dearth of research in the area on this, so maybe it's time for a change. So I changed, and I've not really looked back since.
Lee, cyber psychology is a really niche part of the field of psychology. And there are also many terms to describe what cyber psychology is, including media psychology and digital psychology. From your perspective, can you explain what cyber psychology is and why it's important?
I think, from my perspective, cyber psychology is about how we use digital technology and what it does for us, not necessarily about what it is. So for me as a cyber psychologist, I'm less interested in the technology. I mean, I love technology. I love messing with technology. I like smartphones. I like computers. I like, you know, my gaming consoles, but I'm less interested in what the nuts and bolts are in there. And I'm more interested in what do we do with them and what does it allow us to achieve? And also, as an opposing side to that, what are the consequences of using that technology in our daily lives? So, for example, particularly with things like cybersecurity, it's around that. So we need cybersecurity and we need people to be more cybersecurity aware. But then when we start to throw things at them like, for example, two-factor authentication or password creation is one of my key bugbears, anything like that, people just go, oh, I can't do it. I don't know what I'm doing. And the default is, well, okay, I'm going to create a password that I can remember, or I'm going to create a password that I've already used before because it's easy to remember. So I think it's about that meeting of where technology and human, so the psychology of humans sort of interact and create this sort of maelstrom of problems that arise. I think the terminology is an interesting one, because I think we have the same issue with cybersecurity. As soon as you put the word cyber in front of something, there's a group of people in the population that automatically turn their brains off because they think, oh, it's got something to do with sci-fi, or, oh, it's very technical, or, oh, it's a bit scary, I don't like that. I think sometimes cyber psychology has a slight identity crisis, because you're right, there are different terms that are used across different avenues. And I don't think that helps when we're trying to communicate what cyber psychology does, particularly to organizations and to businesses, because they get confused. They don't really understand what it's about. And I think it's a missing link at the moment. And before I thought, cyber psychology was a niche, I think it's actually expanding. I think it's expanding exponentially, particularly after COVID-19 and the pandemic, and people started to do a lot more things online. We've seen that cyber psychologists and, links to people that have done usability experience from cyber psychology perspective, we've seen their requirements or their needs being, drawn upon a lot more.
And you specialize in the psychology of online safety and security. So you've kind of touched on it already, but how is the psychology side of online security different from the protection side of online security?
I don't think there's a difference. I think in terms of, so from my perspective, I focus on the human side. So I'm really interested in, why do we struggle to follow the prescribed rules that are given to us by organizations, by governments, by the police, by law enforcement? What are the barriers that we put into place that stop us doing that? And why don't we follow the advice? And also, what makes us more susceptible to cybercrime and being victimized online? And that can take many, many forms. What I don't get involved with is the technical side. And time again, I see a massive focus in the literature, in the marketing, cybersecurity is about technical. You've got to be technical. And I think someone posted on LinkedIn last week about, if you're not technical, you can't be in cybersecurity. And I think that's a massive underestimation. And what I will say is, you don't just have to be technical to be in cybersecurity. And if you don't have an understanding of, the ins and outs of why people are doing things in your organization, you're missing a massive leverage point. And also, you're being slightly ignorant. You're being slightly ignorant to the fact that, technical, if technical interventions for cybersecurity and information security worked, we'd have no incidents in the area of cybersecurity. So for those people that say you have to be or must be technical to work in this area, I would say, okay, if that's the reasoning behind this, why are you still having people respond to phishing emails? Why are we still having incidents where people are being ransomwared through the fact that they've opened a phishing email? Why do people fall foul to social engineering? They're not technical aspects, they're psychological aspects.
Exactly that, they are psychological aspects. So what are some of the factors that make individuals more susceptible to becoming victims of cybercrime?
That kind of worms opened. I think if we look at the different elements, so I can group them in terms of the psychological, the dispositional, the situational, and the demographic. So across the board, you've got things like, cognitively, we're not equipped to pay attention to everything, so we miss things. We get fatigued, so we get tired, and then we miss things. We don't pay, as I said, we don't pay attention. So we obviously we miss things. We can't remember stuff. So we don't remember our passwords. So we create ones that are easier for us to remember. Personality is a driver. Things like cognitive biases, heuristics, aspects of locus of control, emotion. I think the list is, I mean, we like to create lists, and we like to create lists because it's nice to partition people into these areas. And I'm guilty of this because it helps me to understand what's going on. But once we look at the, you know, this, I always talk about the pink organic interface that sits behind the computer, which is essentially us. And those pink organic interfaces have that many different foibles and different traits and different dynamics, and we're all different. And it's, you know, we try and pigeonhole people into different boxes to say, well, you know, oh, you've got this personality and you do this and you do that, and that means you're more susceptible. I think it comes down to a combination of factors, and those combination of factors, you know, if I could write a book, which we'll talk about in a moment, if I could write a book, I'd capture it all in the book. But it's important to understand that it's not just a one-size-fits-all approach to understanding what makes us susceptible. It's about helping people understand why they are susceptible so they can take ownership of that susceptibility and make themselves more protected. It's not about designing, it's about designing better experiences for individuals at the end of their journey in cybersecurity so they can take ownership and make more of a, you know, we talk about cybersecurity judgment, giving them the tools to help them understand where to go when they need to make a decision in that sphere.
And there are human factors that influence cybersecurity practices. And I know you'll be going to talk about your new book around this, but is there anything you want to kind of touch on at the moment about how human factors influence cybersecurity practices specifically in the workplace?
Yeah, so just to delve into the terminology. So this is the one thing that gets muddied in the literature. So human factors is the approach we apply to looking at individual differences in cybersecurity. And I think rightly or wrongly, particularly in certain areas, particularly influencers, the term human factors has been taken on board as a thing. They are things, but it's actually a thing. It's an approach. Human factors as an approach has its history in things like ergonomics and human-computer interaction. I've got lots of good colleagues that work in human factors. And they always say, oh, we've heard someone say human factors and such. Well, you know, it's just a language that's being used. And, you know, it's the same as the cyber psychology stuff. The language gets used and it gets perpetrated across different platforms and people just pick it up. So when I talk about human factors, I'm talking about an applying an approach which looks at a generalization across individual incidents to help understand why did that happen, what occurred in that incidents, and how can we use that as a learning experience to better inform people and better train people. A lot of the time, human factors says, oh, you shouldn't be changing people's behavior because it's a hard thing to do. You should design things better. Well, yes, we can design things better, but can we also help people change their behavior? So, you know, human factors is, you know, as a paradigm, it's a really useful paradigm to help understand where things go wrong within, you know, any area within cyber psychology. But for me, it applies itself really usefully to the area of cybersecurity.
What are some of the most significant challenges that individuals face within an organization in maintaining cybersecurity? Because it's slightly different, I'm assuming, to how they do cybersecurity in a personal perspective, or is it?
Ah, well, this is an interesting question because I've long held the belief that people approach their cybersecurity differentially between home and organization. And the reason I thought this is a few years ago, I did a piece of work with a good colleague of mine, Catherine Parsons, who is in Australia. She works as part of the Australian Ministry of Defence. And we looked at this concept of cyber loafing, which is essentially using work-based technology for non-work purposes. People do crazy things with workplace technology that they wouldn't do with their own workplace, their own technology. You know, people will go into work and they will surf pornography. Most people won't do it with their own technology because they're worried about, you know, getting viruses or, you know, other associated issues that can happen. So we came up with this notion that the compensation hypothesis, risk compensation hypothesis, which was postulated many years ago and looked at, particularly when the UK was adopting the rules about seatbelt use in cars. Now, what they did is, they explored, say, people drove a car when they were wearing a seatbelt and when they weren't wearing a seatbelt. And they found that people notionally increased the speed that they were driving when they were wearing a seatbelt because they thought they were more protected. Now, we transferred this into cybersecurity. And we think that people take more risks in an organizational setting because, oh, I've got IT services that if I get phished, well, they'll take care of that. Or if I get a virus at work, well, IT services, they'll take care of that. So when they go into work, it's almost like they go through that magic door that says, well, now you're through this magic door, you could do whatever you want with IT and you do whatever you want with the internet because essentially we'll protect you. But when they go home, maybe they're more cautious. And I'm still moving towards looking at research that would show this. And it's a hard one to do. I think personally, there is a notion that people do generate more risks when they go into work because they think they're more protected. The opposite side of this is, particularly in most organizations now, organizations organize phishing, simulated phishing attacks. And there is a move now where organizations will catch people out. And if you caught out more than 3 or 4 times, you can actually go into a disciplinary procedure. And yeah, they will actually put you in disciplinary procedure. We have to go and have a chat with HR and talk about why do you keep doing this? Are we doing something wrong? Are we not presenting the messages very well? Or are you just missing it? You know, is there a reason why you're missing it? So yeah, it's a really interesting, you know, area to talk about.
When you were talking about the seatbelts, I read somewhere that when cyclists are wearing helmets, motorists are less likely to give them all that space. And also I read when during COVID, if you're wearing a mask, you're more likely to get closer to someone because you think you're protected. So it's kind of makes
risk
sense.
Compensation. Yeah, risk compensation. Yeah, it's
fascinating.
We talked about it in the paper, that 2017 paper on cyber loafing. So it's something we've come across, and I've not seen anybody else discuss it in the literature, the research literature. But I think what muddied the water is during COVID, obviously lots of people working from home. And then people started to think a bit more about their security in the house. But then you get a lot of people that were working from home and obviously sharing a working environment with partners and with their kids and all that sort of stuff. And it's like, well, did you take precautions when you were working from home? Did you explore your cybersecurity at home? And I think for many people, they just took it for granted.
There's also the concept of bring your own device to work or use your own device.
Yeah,
and BYOD,
yeah.
Yeah. So do you think that also has an impact from a cognitive perspective of this is my stuff, so therefore I'm less likely to click on an email or more cognitively aware of potential phishing emails?
I think maybe, but then people take their own devices into work and then use the Wi-Fi at work. So they, you know, are they you know, carrying out the same amount of risks online through those profiles. And I think we talk about cognition, but there's other drivers, things like fear of missing out. People want to stay online. They want to keep abreast of information. I want to check my Facebook profile. I want to see who's liked my picture of my breakfast I put on this morning. You know, I want to see who's liked that picture of me on the holiday last week. You know, that fear of missing out is a massive driver for people to take risks with their cybersecurity. And again, we've done research on that to show that fear of missing out does influence people's cybersecurity awareness and their attitudes towards cybersecurity. I think bring your own device. I know that's a nightmare for most system administrators because, you know, they've got a good handle on what things are attached to their network at any one time. But then you start introducing devices that people are bringing in, and that brings in a whole another level, another layer of risks that could be attached to it. And I think policing that for a lot of organizations is difficult. And where do you stop? Because, you know, lots of people, I think one of the things you find is people get annoyed with the technology they're supplied with through work, because most of the time the technology you get through work is usually crap. It's usually stuff that you don't want to use. So you go out and buy your own and then bring it in because you'd rather work on your own device because you know you're more productive. Employers never really cotton onto this and don't realize that actually people can be more productive if we get them the things they need. I know there's cost attached to it. There's always a residual cost. That's fine. But then look at the impact on productivity. If people like the technology they're using, they're going to be more productive. And if they can use it, they're going to be less likely to make errors with the stuff that you already got. So, you know, it's that catch 22. You know, people like taking tablets into work. Tablets are a lot easier to carry around than laptops. Laptops are bulky. Tablets are easy to transport. And, you know, you can also do a lot more with tablets that you can't do with laptops. So, yeah, so it's, I don't know. It is another one of those.
Yeah.
Endless conundrums.
Yeah, I think you're right with businesses that they don't look at the longer term profits in terms of an increased productivity, but rather short term costs are going to cost me more, so therefore I won't buy it. Where actually they'll earn so much more from the extra productivity. And the other thing I was thinking while you're chatting about that, one of the things I talk to people, especially businesses, about is not so much the fear of missing out, because that's a very personal thing, but the fear of missing something important. And that's what's keeping people online and keeping them checking their emails at 11 o'clock at night. Mm. And I wonder if that's also part of why they potentially...
That's still fear of missing out, because it's still... I think we badge fear of missing out as a more of a social media thing, but fear of missing out can be, oh, you know, for example, academics, have I missed out on the fact I've had a paper accepted? Or have I missed out on a really interesting email from someone? Or, you know... What else could crop up at 1 o'clock in the morning on Christmas Day that I might have missed out on? And I'm guilty of doing it as the next person. You know, we like to be connected. We like to know what's going on. And then we strive to be disconnected. We strive to try and switch off. But yeah, I think fear of missing out is a big driver for a lot of people taking risks with, you know, being connected and staying online.
Yeah, I agree. And especially if you've got an urgent email coming through about let's pay this invoice, it's that kind of fear that I'm going to miss something and I'm going to get in trouble for it. Mm. So it's a real, real tough one. Then let's chat about your recent or your book you've already written. And you did a PhD in cognitive psychology and you spoke about your background in cognitive psychology and written a book called Cybercognition. And in this book, you delve into the impact of digital technology on human cognition. And what was your motivation for writing Cybercognition?
So I think I talk about this in the start of the book, because I remember going to just to make your podcast listeners aware, I hate going to London. It's my worst nightmare. I don't know what it is about the place. I come out in hives. I won't go on the tube. If I have to get from point A to point B in London, I walk. because number one, I get a chance to do people watching. I get to engage with the wonderful people of London. That's sarcasm, by the way. But I don't know what it is about the place. It just drives me nuts. But then I remember going to a research meeting with a colleague. I was back in, it was 2015 or 2014. And I remember I was trapped with him on the tube in the height of summer. And I was trying to distract myself because I could feel the panic setting in. I was trying to distract myself. And while I was doing that, I noticed in one of the carriages, there was a mother who was on the phone, and she'd got a young child in the pushchair. And basically the mother was transfixed by something on the mobile phone. And the child in the pushchair, all it was saying was, "Mommy iPad, Mommy iPad, Mommy iPad." And basically the mother, she didn't disengage from looking at her phone. She just reached there and picked out the iPad and gave it to the child. And that was it. The child was happy. The mother was happy. And I just thought, oh dear, this is the problem. This is something I need to talk about. And then I got into, obviously, the stuff on cybercognition through doing the work with DSDL. And looking at sort of online information processing and how we approach bits of sort of reasoning and decision making online. And that just got me motivated into thinking, well, there's a body of research here that's not been captured in a specific text or a specific sort of area. I know the phrase cybercognition had, I couldn't find anywhere it had been used before in a substantive way that had aligned it with a particular area or practice in terms of cyber psychology. And I know it's been used since to refer to elements of what I've been talking about or what I was talking about. But I think I want to try and capture what is the current zeitgeist of how are we interacting with digital technology and things like smartphones and the internet, and what's it doing in terms of cognition, and what are the processes we use when we approach those things? So how do we assess things like the believability of information online? How do we use things like endorsement heuristics to sort of assess whether something's true or not true? So that set me down that path. And I really liked writing that book. Number one, it was easy because it was mostly stuff that I'd done before, and mostly research around the area I was interested in. And I felt that it got a time and a place. I mean, the book now is, I feel like it's years ago, but people are still coming to me and say, "Yeah, I've just read your book." And one of my students last week, "I've just bought your book. Would you sign it for me?" And I'm thinking, this is really cringy. I will do it. But yeah, it's like amazing to see that people come and they've got my book in their hand. And I still get imposter syndrome about writing it, but it's really, it's really nice to know that people have read it and they found it useful in their careers or their pathways.
So what are the main areas of themes that you explore within the book?
There's sections on how we look for credibility online, what mechanisms we use there. There's a section on I talk at length about smombies, smartphone zombies, and the way in which we can miss things when we're on our smartphones. I have wonderful replete evidence of people doing this on a daily basis. Because I commute a lot, I see people using smartphones all the time. The things people miss or the things people don't pay attention to when they're on their phones. I saw someone using a phone the other day at a train station, and they were getting very animated and very, the discussion was getting even more and more animated. And in the end, he almost threw his phone up in the air and it almost went on the train tracks. And I'm thinking, is this the state of the way in which we interact with technology? I talk about the use of technology in education and about how education is influenced by the use of technology. there wasn't much in terms of AI when I was writing that text. I'd like to do a bit on AI now and generative AI, because that's getting quite a lot of attention, particularly in a lot of higher education institutions. Talk about different generational aspects of technology use. I think things like the emergence of technology addiction, things like internet addiction, smartphone addiction, how that can influence people's perceptions. And then there's a strand of work where we talk about the myth of multitasking. The amount of times I get told, "Oh, I've been multitasking," and I say, "Well, you don't multitask. What you actually do is do two tasks very quickly in concert, but you can't do two things at once because it's physically impossible. You might think you can, but actually you're switching between two tasks very quickly." Talk about interruptions and how they can affect your cognitive processes. I think that's mostly. I say that's mostly it. I think that's the main bits.
The main bits, yeah. That's one of my favorite bits of your book. And I often talk about that when I talk about to professionals about using or having their phone and their tablets and all these other things open, and the cognitive lag and how we kind of stop thinking about it and it takes ages to get back to a place where you're back in, and thinking about the task to the same level as you were before.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because it's one of the most fascinating things about our cognitive processing and our focus.
Yeah. Task reuptake cost. It's essentially the fact that because you've got interrupted, the longer the period between the task you were doing and the time you take to reuptake that task, the more effort you have to exert to get to the point where you initially were. So, for example, this morning I started writing some bits on my new book, and then I had an email from a student, and then I had a colleague ring me, and then I had another email that got in the way, and then I came back to what I was writing, and it was like I had to read back over two pages to figure out where I was before I could start writing again. And that's exactly the same with all the processes. You think about all the processes that happen when you get interrupted, and you have to piece together a jigsaw. What was I doing at this point before I was interrupted, and how do I get back on track? And you have to reignite all of those cognitive pathways and those cognitive traces to get to the point where you can successfully reinitiate that task. And the other thing is, you may make errors during that process. And this is the one thing we've been looking at in terms of cybersecurity. The fact that you might get interrupted while you're writing a really important email or responding to an important email, and you get interrupted by an immediate requirement that you need to do from your line manager or someone else that needs your urgent input. And you go back to the email, you make a mistake, you send it to the wrong person, that results in you having to send an apology. It might have released sensitive data to someone. I think that interruptions and, you know, those errors that occur on a daily basis, and we all do it, we've all done it. And it's, you know, that retracing of your steps. It's almost like going back to when you forget something. So you've lost your keys, and you go back into the room where you think you last had your keys, and you retrace your steps. You have to do the same thing with a task.
And it also explains for me why sometimes I start something at the beginning of the day and it won't take long to do, but by the end of the day, I still haven't done it. Because I get so distracted and I keep on coming back and I have to retrace my steps and don't get very far and then get distracted again. It's really productivity.
Easily done.
Are there any other key insights that you can share from your book, or is it just buy the book and read it?
Buy the book and read it, and let me know what you think of it. I'm always happy to hear people's opinions on the book. I think it's probably a bit due for a little revision and an update. As an author, it's nice for people to use the book. It's nice for people to read the book. I don't think I'm going to retire on the millions and millions of pounds I've earned from the book. I don't think it was ever about the money. It's never about the money. It's more about getting the message out there and getting people to understand the way in which you know, digital technology is affecting their cognitive processes. But having that discussion, having that, you know, that engagement from people and getting more people interested in the area, so we get more researchers going, get doing the research that I can't do.
And I think that's one of the key things, is getting more people into the field and getting into them, getting them helping research and helping grow this, because there's so much we don't know yet, or so much that still needs researching. And just one last thing on that book, just want to find out from you what the impact is of smartphone use on attention, and what advice you'd give about managing digital device use.
Switch them off. Switch it off. Put it in the bin. Switch it off. Hide it in the desk. I think there's a variety of ways in which it can impact us. And obviously that one main one is the interruptions. We talk about a digital attentional economy, or the economy of attention, and all these notifications that we get bombarded with time and time again. And I can't remember the exact statistic, but there's a statistic out there, I think it's in the book, that, you know, on average, we interact with a notification on our phone within, it's a matter of seconds. And you think, well, if that's the case, then what happens to that task that I started before that interruption happened? And how much lost time have I got added up in terms of, you know, all the things that I've done instead of doing that thing? You know, we talk about that, you know, that lost period of time, that lag again, when you get interrupted. And, you know, smartphones, smart devices, I mean, they're useful. They're there for a reason. I think if you use them wisely and use them for a purpose, then, you know, why not use them? They're a tool at the end of the day. But I think it's where we become obsessive about these things, and, you know, we get sucked into the wonderful, you know, YouTube video rabbit holes and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, I say, you know, be mindful of when you are using them, and be mindful of what you're supposed to be doing, and try and set aside a time for using them when you need to, and when you don't. And tell people, say, look, you know, I'm not going to be reachable on my smartphone for this period of time. You know, if it's an essential thing, you know, if it's an emergency, fine. But if it's just to catch up about something that's completely innocuous and doesn't mean anything, then don't bother, because I won't answer.
I think sometimes tricky for people who work and have to be in Slack channel or on Teams chats constantly. I think it might be tricky for them sometimes to switch off from notifications and from cell phone, mobile phones and that stuff. But I think you're right, it's about communicating to others. This is my period when I am focused, and I'm not contactable unless it's a super emergency. Otherwise, it can work.
Yeah, I think that's an organizational policy that needs to be implemented to say, okay, so do we do these Teams channels in the morning, and then in the afternoon, no Teams channels? Or, you know, is it a lot of people implement this organizational aspect of you respond to emails in the morning and at night. So there's in the day, there's no email traffic. So that means that you've got, you know, you send your emails or responses in the morning, and then at night you go back to them and see what the responses are, because that means all day you've got no interruptions, which means you can go with it. It's really hard to do, because, you know, people want information. I think the problem is with interconnectivity and digital technology, we always expect people to be there. We expect the synchronous communication to happen. You know, we don't want communication within a day. We want it in seconds or minutes. We want a response instantaneously. And then we get frustrated when people don't reply to us, you know, within a matter of seconds. And I think it's about a mind change. We need to stop that, you know, that feeling that we need to be connected, and say, well, you know, I'm taking responsibility for my own time. You can reply to me when you want to. I will reply to you when I want to.
I think you're right. It's about those expectations, and whether it's work or home, there's a number of times that I haven't responded within a couple of hours, and people are kind of going, well, where are you? Why haven't you responded? Have I done something wrong? No, I'm busy. I've turned my phone off, and I'll respond to you when I can. So it feels almost as though that expectation of immediate responses has translated into a personal environment.
Yeah.
And it it makes it really tricky to change that culture and that way of thinking about responses. And I think you're right, that you expect synchronous communication everywhere. Going on to your new book, so you're currently writing another cyber psychology book. What is this book about and what are the themes you cover? And more importantly, well, actually as importantly, is when is it due to be released?
When is it due to be released is as soon as I finish it. So I'm writing the book with my colleague, Chloe Riding. A few years ago, I started to look at the body of research in the area of, you know, applying human factors to cybersecurity. And obviously most of my research focuses on this area. And I was talked to colleagues, I talked to practitioners, chief information security officers about these topics. And I thought, well, there's a gap in the literature in this area, because you've got certain frameworks and certain things that look at the application of human factors in cybersecurity, but there's nothing that pulls it all together. And I thought, well, okay, put your money where your mouth is and get on with doing something. So a couple of years ago, I contacted a few publishers and sort of suggested, well, I've got this idea for a book. I can do a draft. I've got some, people that would be prepared to be reviewers for the proposal. What do you think? And I put a few things on LinkedIn to see what people thought. Some people thought it was a crazy idea. Some people were really supportive. So I just got on with it. It's essentially looking at the application of human factors to cybersecurity. And within the book, we've got, an outline of what information security is and what cybersecurity is from a practitioner, a working definition point of view, particularly within the field of cyber psychology. And then we move into looking at the individual differences that shape how people interact with cybersecurity, as well as what makes them vulnerable to things related to cybercrime. We've got a section on the psychology of cybercrime. There's bits on looking at the personality differences and cybersecurity. We've got a section on looking at how we measure cybersecurity awareness and the mechanisms and the tools we can use there. There's a bit looking at how counterproductive work behaviors can influence people's adherence to cybersecurity policies. There's lots. When I first started, I was given an initial brief of where you can do 60,000 words. We've had to go back and renegotiate. It's approaching 100,000 words now. And it covers, it covers as many aspects of the things that differentiate people in terms of their adherence to cybersecurity as we can possibly fit into that book. It's been a difficult one. It's been a lot harder than the previous one because it's a lot more involved, because there's a lot of crossover. There's a lot of different elements. There's things like you've got this, personality factors, you've got the cognitive factors, you've got dispositional factors, you've got situational factors, you've got influence of culture, then you've got organizational culture, you've got cybersecurity culture. Yeah.
So all those things that most people who say you need to be technically minded to be in cybersecurity don't take into account.
Yeah, there you go.
So from a practical perspective, you do quite a lot of work with industry and government. Mm-hmm. And you've specifically collaborated with law enforcement agencies like the East Midlands Police. How does your research in cyber psychology contribute to preventing and combating cybercrime?
I think it's about the awareness. I think it's always about the awareness. I think it's about messaging as well. I mean, one of the things we found, particularly as working with East Midlands Police, is that we always struggled, or that one of the things they always struggled with was getting a message across that people could understand, and also actionable messages that they could use. And I think one of the things that we started to do was look at the literature in the area and look at, the research on, messaging, things like behavioral nudges. Behavioral nudges that have been used in the past, and we talk about that in the book, about how do you get people, how do you influence people to do something without actually getting them to realize that they're doing it? And it's all about that influence and persuasion process of, you know, you can influence people in a way that, you know, they don't actually realize that, that, you know, they're falling into the trap of you wanting them to do the thing. There's an example of, you know, the positive messages and social norming where you say X percentage of people who did this or X percentage of people who in your position did this. Are you going to be one of those people? And social norm and social influence are really, really useful. One of the things that was implemented within the region, as it was part of the national strategy, was to get people to think before they replied to things like phishing emails. So it was that the take five approach, to take 5 minutes to think about whether you should be responding to this email. Because obviously, one of the drivers for people to respond to an email is the urgency. The scammers want you to reply quickly because you're not thinking about it. And if you don't think about it, you don't reason. If you don't reason, then you don't understand the fact it's a scam. If you have that reflective period where you sit down and go, oh, did I really pay my TV license? Or did I really order that thing that I'm being asked to pay for? Or have I got a parcel that's coming today that I need to log in and give my details for? That process of just sitting back allows you to engage that in that more systematic processing mechanism, which means that you're less likely to fall foul of scams. So that was, I think that's one of the main things that we worked on. And then it's also looking at, So the psychology of the victim, what happens to the victim, what's their pathway, what's their treatment? I think we found that particularly in discussions with law enforcement, this isn't to single any particular law enforcement agency out, is there's a lot of victim blaming that goes on when it comes to cyber crime. You know, we hear a lot when people say, oh, I've been I'm being bullied online. I'm being bullied on Facebook. And one of the responses is, well, come off Facebook. And it's like, well, you're then blaming the victim, not the perpetrator. Don't attack the victim, because what you're saying to them is stop what you do on your normal daily activities and let the cyber criminal or the person that's bullying you win. Whereas what we say is, well, no, surely you should give him their better advice about, well, have you thought about restricting your privacy? Have you, you know, blocked the people that are, you know, being problematic? Have you restricted the amount of information you're putting online? So, you know, that's come across quite, and we actually produced, there's a book chapter we produced on that with two colleagues about, you know, that we had a quote from one of the police saying, why don't you just block them? You know, and it's about, well, yes, you can do that, but then it's, you know, it's more in depth than that, because people are getting, you know, the similarity I always draw with this is you hear this a lot when people are, you know, victims of sexual abuse, sexual harassment is, oh, they were asking for it. And it's that same notion that people that go online and engage in social media, oh, they were asking for it because they're not. No, they're not. They don't go out with a sticker on them saying, I want to be harassed or I want to be bullied. They're going out because they want to connect with their friends. They want to engage with the wider community. They want to discuss things with the wider community. And you're reining in their enjoyment of that, you know, that facilitative aspect of being online. And I think that's one of the things that we find with a lot of law enforcement is they just don't understand, you know, they don't have the expertise to understand that is a process that people engage in.
When you're talking about that originally, I was thinking it's similar to those who are being raped. It's like, you shouldn't have wore short skirts. You shouldn't have got yourself in this situation. No. And I guess in some ways it's like helping people understand how not to get into that situation rather than you it's your fault. They say they may still get into that situation, but at least they've got some tools and hints and tips of how to get out of it, how to avoid it.
Yeah, so. And it's definitely about signposting. I think that's one of the things that we struggle with when it comes to cybersecurity and cybercrime is that the signposts for help for people, they're not great. They're not great at all. You know, I asked my students, what would you do if you were, you know, you were a victim of cybercrime? None of them know. None of them know where to go to report it. They, you know, they won't, oh, do I report it to the police? Well, yes, you would, but there are mechanisms for reporting it. And they just see that law enforcement is ineffectual because they just believe that, you know, the cyber criminals are more advanced and better at doing things than the police are, which is, you know, it's a sad state of affairs. I'm not saying the police are. That's the you know, the perception of these people that are reporting these things.
I'm going to go chat on to what you offer at Nottingham Trent University. But before that, I just wanted to dive into a bit of an area that we spoke about in our initial discussion, when you said there's quite a few businesses and industries that come to you as an academic and ask for your help, and they kind of expect you to give it for free. But that's not really how you operate when you do projects and work with industry or with governments. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So I think there's always a misnomer that academics are just, we're a free resource for people to dip into, and, you know, we give our advice for free. And, you know, I always feel a bit disingenuous when I have to mention things like, oh, we might need a budget for this. I think for me, it's about the expectancy of expertise. I wouldn't go to I wouldn't go to someone who was a psychiatrist and, you know, expect them to give their time for free, or, you know, an expert in a particular field. Like I wouldn't go to an architect and say, oh, would you mind designing me this, because, you know, I want to build a new house. You know, you have to pay for it. And I'm not saying, you know, I'm not saying if you want to talk to me, you have to, you know, you have to pay me by the minute. I'm saying if you want to, you know, as an academic who's got expertise in a practical application of cyber psychology to a very important field, I'm more than happy to talk to anybody about it. And if you want to do research collaboration, and if you want to get on board and you want advice and you want consultancy, you know, there's a payment. There's a payment process, and, you know, that payment isn't so I can go off and have a sunny time in the Bahamas. It's about, you know, us having that external income to show that our expertise is required, but also, you know, the university at the end of the day is a business. And, you know, businesses need to make money, and businesses make money off the expertise of their academics. And that is the process we have to engage in. And, you know, like I said, I'm always happy to have discussions with people around these sort of areas. But when we have these discussions, you know, organizations have to be aware that there is, you know, a residual cost that has to be passed on at some point when we get into the, you know, the planning and facilitation stages of those projects.
But also, you are an academic and you do lectures and you co-lead a whole course. So if you're doing something practical, it takes away from the time that you would otherwise spend with students.
Exactly. Yeah. At the end of the day, you know, academics are primarily, my job is to teach. So anything that takes me away from my lovely students and me teaching my wonderful cyber psychology students, you know, there has to be checks and balances. And I think sometimes I think organizations think you're being mercenary about it. And it's about, couldn't you just do this and couldn't you just do that? And I've done it in the past, and I, you know, I've got caught out because, you know, you get people ask more and more of you, and, you know, I start to feel guilty because I've given something already and I feel like I have to give more. But now I think, you know, in order to build a relationship and to build a productive relationship, if I offer services for free, does the organisation then think, well, if he's offering them for free, are his services worth any? Are they worth anything? Whereas if you attach a payment to them, you start to get a little bit more respect, and also, you know, you start to see more benefits from doing those things. And obviously, there's outputs to this because, you know, from the work you get things like reports, you can get a documentation that can be used in you know, later, you know, advertising material, and it also has a knock-on effect in terms of cost, because let's not forget that most of the stuff I'm doing is about stopping organizations being victims of cybercrime. So what's that worth in terms of your organizational reputation?
Exactly. And it's not the technical side as such. It's the human side. No, so how do you change
the human side? Yeah.
Yeah. And that's so much more important in many ways to help that prevention. The courses that you offer at Nottingham Trent University in cyber psychology, you've got an undergrad options and you've got an MSc options.
Yeah. So as part of the undergraduate course in the final year, there's an optional module on cyber psychology, which is well attended. We have a lot of lovely students that come onto that. And I think for a lot of them, it's an eye opener when they come into it. We also have a couple of, so in the third year, students engage in what we call project labs, which is where they take part in sort of labs that have a thematic area attached to them. We've done one previously where we've looked at the development of psychometric scales in cyber psychology, which is, we've read anything from fake news, misinformation, through to artificial intelligence, through to, there's been lots. Online learning, attitudes towards online learning. And that's always been really popular. I delivered that with my colleague, Dr. Una Steer, who's at Nottingham Trent. And latterly, we've got another project lab where we're looking at the use of vignette-based experimental designs for exploring things related to online risk, which is anything from the use of AI through to cybersecurity. And then the master's offering is a one-year course in MSc, which I'm co-course lead with Chloe Riding. That has been running now for, I want to say, it's got to be nearly 7 years. It was running well before I joined NTU, and it was sort of, I think, the brainchild of Daria Cuss and Dr. Mark, Professor Mark Griffiths. Sorry, Mark. He was my mentor. It grew off the back of their expertise, and then we've got other people that teach on that course within the department. But yeah, it's a year-long course. We have lots of students who join that, lots of international students, lots of locally grown students. Cover everything on the course. From the areas I teach on human factors and cybersecurity, online deviance, online sexual offending, the psychology of personality online, there's aspects of digital cyberspace, radicalization online, online banter, cyberbullying, cyberaggression. There's the psychology of applied digital technology. We have a bespoke practice module where people go in and we do consultants reports based around a cyber psychology related issue or topic. We have input from industry who they feed into some of the scenarios that we talk about. We've had guest talks from lots of organizations on particular areas related to cyber psychology. It's a very much, even though there's lots of theoretical stuff, it's very much based around a sort of a practitioner, you know, the notion of being a practical application of cyber psychology research. And we do have a lot of people that have come in from industry, particularly from cybersecurity and user design, they've come in and use the research to help them understand what they're doing. And a lot of our graduates then go on to do research and positions in those areas. And we've got a lot of high profile graduates that have gone to do things in cyber psychology, cyber security, sort of user design experience.
That's very cool. So it's a taught master's with a dissertation at the end.
Mm-hmm. Taught master's and a dissertation. Yeah, it's face-to-face. Based in Nottingham, so you get to speak to lovely me and my colleagues. Dissertation, which you get assigned a supervisor at the end of term two, and you talk to your supervisor about your ideas for your dissertation. The students are currently going through that process now, and chatting about their ideas. And there's lots of wonderful ideas that come out of those discussions. And we always encourage our students to think about going on to publish their work as well.
What skills do you think are essential for students who want to enter this field of cyberpsychology?
I want to learn and I want to engage. And some past experiences, some past background in academia. We don't ask for a formal degree in psychology because we fill in the gaps for our students. The course is aimed at people with unlimited knowledge of psychology. So if you come from a very technical background, don't worry, we can help plug that gap. It's very much a degree for people that want to learn about psychology. It's not a technical degree. It's not about the technical side. We don't do anything related to programming, which we have to make sure that's clear. We get a lot of people thinking that it's all about, you know, there's some elements of programming, computer forensics. We don't do that. I think definitely it's a thirst for learning, a thirst for engagement, you know, a willingness to get involved and get stuck in, and you know, a willingness to engage. You know, that's one of the things that the course is so good about. And, you know, our students are so, you know, our group of students, the amount of times I've been distracted in a lecture because we've gone down a rabbit hole about talking about things. The degree itself is very much geared around the discussion and the engagement of students in the area rather than just the standing in front of people talking at them and not listening.
So if someone wanted to apply to the next master's course, when is the cutoff for application?
I think the cutoff for application, I don't think it's... I think it is ongoing. I think people can apply up to August, September. What I will say is to get applications in quickly because it does get subscribed very early on. And we're always hoping to have a chat with people that if they're interested in it, they want to know a bit more about the course. We have open days at NTU as well, postgraduate open days where people can come along and talk to us about the course. We're more than happy if you're an international student, you want to talk to us about the course and you want to do a Teams call or a Zoom call, get in touch with us. We can talk about that. But yeah, as far as I'm aware, in terms of the administration, there's no firm deadline in which we say, oh, no, we can't take you.
And then they're just all that information's on the Nottingham Trent website.
Yeah, you can find it all on the Nottingham Trent University website.
Fantastic. Lee, we're coming to the end of the podcast interview, and there's three standard questions I normally ask my guests. And the first is, what is the most important question I haven't asked you yet?
What type of Haribo do I like? Tangfastics, by the way. What is the most important question you haven't asked me? What's the future? I think what's the future is important. I think future engagement from organizations is important. I think we need better engagement from organizations across the board, not just in terms of cybersecurity, but in terms of cyber psychology. And also organizations feeding into that next generation of cyber psychologists in a way that looks at what skills are they missing in terms of their digital infrastructure and how can we shape the next lot of graduates in a way that allows them to then utilize those resources or utilize their skills in a way that allows businesses to grow and to, you know, expand things like end user experiences, customer experiences, generating customer metrics. There's a raft of ways in which cyber psychology can help people in organization. I think that's what we need to do for the future, and looking at that engagement, that's got to be one of the most important things.
That was my next question, is what is the future of cyber psychology and the role of online safety and security? And it kind of is a lot of greed.
I'd like to think we're moving towards some sort of validation for the area, some sort of, you know, recognized status. I know we've got BPS recognition in terms of the area as a whole, but it would be nice to start to think about what makes a cyber psychologist, what are the routes that people can go through, and to make that a bit more concrete, a bit more, you know, approachable for people.
Yeah. And it's also kind of, in some ways, I guess, highlighting how cyber psychologists can be used in organizations or in practical daily life. That I don't think there's a lot of, A, there's not a lot of businesses and industries that know about cyber psychology, and B, don't know how it can be practical and how it can add so much value in a workplace. So you've got a big job to do to kind of get that education and that knowledge out.
We have.
And my last question is, if there's any particularly favorite cyber psychology book or book in your area of expertise that you recommend to others to read?
That's an interesting one. I don't know, because I tend not to read a lot of books these days because of writing them and always writing papers and journals. I tend not to get time to read books. I always like reading the old science fiction stuff, which isn't a textbook. Things like William Gibson's work, because that's where I first started to experience things like, you know, the terminology behind cyberspace and, you know, things like Neuromancer was always one of my go-to favorite books. I don't know. I like John Sula's work. I read a lot of John Sula's work, you know, or his. I mean, that formed quite a lot of the basis foundation for a lot of the work in the initial parts of the book. And I spoke to John at length about some of his work. And, you know, it was really interesting to chat to him because he's, you know, he's always open for a chat. He's always open for discussions. So I think, yeah, any of John's work, there's lots of good sort of standard psychology textbooks. There was an edited text by Alison Attrill, who's one of my old colleagues. That's a nice sort of opener for people that want to get into the area. There's lots of nice little sort of beginner textbooks. There's a few on sort of the psychology of online crime, and I think Granny Kerwin, who's based at IADT in Ireland, she wrote one that I read quite a lot. So there's lots out there to go at.
Yeah, there is a lot. And I'm going to recommend your book just because I can and because I found it incredibly fascinating. I love the cognitive side of cyber psychology. So it's been, that was a really good book. And I really enjoyed it. Lee, thank you so much for joining me on Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. It's been fabulous to catch up with you, and I really look forward to catching up with you again in the future.
Thank you, Caroline. Thanks for having me.